Betsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And I am so thrilled and honored that my guest today, well, he is amazing. Steve Barry, thank you for joining me here on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you for having me back.
Wow, it is just wonderful. I love your books. And the new book, The Last Kingdom, is terrific.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it so much. Cotton's back. He took a year off, but he's back in with a new adventure.
Well, we needed it. And this is book 17 in this wonderful, wonderful series. And of all your books, and I love them all. I love anything to do with history. And there is no writer who writes history as well as you do. You know, lots of thriller writers and cozy mystery writers will use history as a backdrop, but you actually know history, you study it, you go really deep. Your books are so accurate, I think, really, you only make up a little bit, and what you discover with your research just is always so fascinating. And in this story, which is set in Bavaria, and talks about the Wittelsbach family, which is something that's very close to my heart because I am working on a book about the Empress Sissi, the wife of Franz Joseph. So
yes.
I have been to Bavaria many times. I've been to her home in Possenhofen where she was born, which is now turned into a very fancy apartment complex now. But I've been there. I've walked, you know, in her footsteps. And I've been, of course, to these castles that you talk about. Most of my listeners don't know that they've actually seen the castle that you talk about in the book about the Wittelsbach. They don't know anything about Ludwig II. So tell us about it. Isn't it an exciting story?
It is, and it deals with two of my favorite things. One, Bavaria. I love it too. I've been there many, many times, and it also deals with King Ludwig II, who is one of my favorite historical characters. He was connected to Elizabeth Sissi. They almost married, but did not. But they remained close friends, you know, for the rest of his life. I've wanted to put Cotton into a story with Bavaria and King Ludwig, but I haven't been able to really assemble it and put it together. But I finally came up with the right thing. I was able to incorporate the three castles that Ludwig created, Herrenchiemsee, Linderhof, and Neuschwanstein, and you're correct, Neuschwanstein is one that people will recognize because that's what Walt Disney saw in the 1930s, and he used it as the model for Sleeping Beauty's castle in Disneyland. And so these three castles figure very much into the story. There's a historical fact I came across, which was true. Ludwig was... People call him Mad King Ludwig. I don't really like that term. I don't think he was mad. I think he was troubled. I think he had some mental deficiencies. Today we would probably have called him chronically depressed or bipolar. We could have treated him with therapy and drugs. He might have been able to survive in good shape, but in the 19th century that wasn't possible. So he fell into this deep, deep delusional world. And in that world he was extremely imaginative. He created a whole lot, but he also had a lot of problems for himself. He sent a man around the world to find himself a new kingdom. He actually did do this. He wanted to find a kingdom where he could go and rule like a mythical ruler of old, not constrained by any laws or anything. And the man did do that, and he wrote a journal about it, which I was able to see. And in the real life, they never found that last kingdom, but in my book they do. And now Germany, China, and the United States are all after it, but for entirely different reasons. And that's where the chase comes on.
And the reasons are very relevant to today's world. And that's what makes it so exciting. You discovered something, and you, as I have, just been fascinated by this family that most people don't, you know, they have not heard that name. Mm-hmm. But it's a fascinating family, and Sissi did love him very much. I mean, she was very fond of him. What happened to him, of course, is a tragedy. But as you said, being probably bipolar and having delusions, in some ways we owe him a lot because with his delusions, he built these wonderful castles.
Yes, that's right. He was a very forward-thinking guy. He had a great imagination, but he was also a guy that clung to the past, too, and could not let go of the past. And there's no question he had some problems and he had some issues. But he was an... enigmatic figure. If I ever get a chance to write a pure historical novel set totally in the past with historical aspects, I would love to do a novel, as you're doing with Sissy, I'd love to do one on Ludwig. I think he'd be a fascinating subject.
Well, he is, and of course, when you go to the castles and when you see 70 rooms and everything is the imagination that he had, the ideas he had, it's thrilling. And every once in a while, I will think about, you know, modern millionaires, billionaires, and the kind of places that they're building. And they don't have this imagination. They're not building something that's going to be not as a glory to beauty, just to build something big. But when he went big, he went big.
He did. He had a great imagination. He was really something. Neuschwanstein Feinstein inside is just magical. It's like a Wagner opera with all the paintings and everything that are in there. It's like something from Disneyland in some respects, but it was real. And this guy had this fantastic imagination. And those three sites remain the three largest tourist attractions in all of Germany, generating hundreds of millions of euros, for the country. So he had a lasting impact.
It's true. And his eye for beauty. Of course, he adored Sissy because at the time she was considered the most beautiful woman in Europe. And I think he just loved looking at beautiful things.
They had an interesting relationship. It came close to getting married, but Ludwig was not, that was not his thing. And so he wisely walked away from that. He's in many ways a tragic figure, and that's what would make it interesting to do a novel with him, to explore all that happened to him. I mean, his life just spiraled down, and then he was deposed from his throne, and then died 3 days later under mysterious circumstances that we still to this day have no idea how he died.
And I think Sissy always believed that he was murdered, of course. Labeling him mad is so weak, it's so lazy, because there's so much more to him.
Yeah, he wasn't, as I said, I don't like to use that term, mad, with him. I think he was troubled, but that didn't mean that he did not have an extremely sharp intellect and extremely sharp mind. I mean, he actually even conceived of a flying air machine similar to a Zeppelin that long before dirigibles were even created or used. He came up with an idea for one. He had a lot of thoughts in that brain that he has. He just, unfortunately, had these problems. His brother was certifiably insane and was institutionalized. His mother had trouble as well. And so it ran in the family very strongly, and it got to Ludwig. He ascended to the throne at 18, so he had no choice. He had to go in very young. But he died when he was 42.
Well, the Wittelsbach had, they definitely had some problems in that family. But the idea of finding a perfect kingdom for him to rule, that certainly gave you fodder for.
It did. And then when we located where that kingdom was, it made it, and made it very relevant today. That's the thing about my books. I have to have something from the past, something real, something that is pretty cool and you want to know more about. But that something also still has to be relevant today. And I was able to find a connection between that. I don't want to say that because it'll give away what's in the book, but there's something, a very interesting connection between Hawaii and another place in the world that will shock the readers. I know it shocked me, but it's true.
Yeah, it is. It is fascinating. The story that you weave is so incredible. But that's what happens with all of your stories. They are, on the one hand, they're incredible. And then, on the other hand, they are credible because you base them on facts. It's like, when you wrote Patriot Threat. What I love when a book sends me to another place, because when you read one of your books, it opens up this whole era, whatever you're writing about, that you want to learn more. And I remember when I read Patriot Threat, which is, of course, the one about the 16th Amendment. And I think it's still rather relevant today. People are thinking a lot about income tax at the moment.
Yeah, extremely relevant today. And after writing that book, I'm firmly convinced that the 16th Amendment was never legally ratified by this country. I don't think there's any question it was never legally ratified. It's fascinating. And that thriller deals with that, the question of whether the 16th Amendment was legally put into place or not. And it's an argument the federal courts don't want to hear anything about, but I think there's some serious questions as to whether that amendment was properly done. And that it formed a great novel, and the Patriot Threat was, you know, was the novel that dealt with that.
Yeah, well, I thought it was a fantastic novel, and I remember when I finished it, I said, okay, I have to find out if this is true. And I too agree that I don't think it was ever ratified. And maybe somebody will come along and say, let's get rid of this income tax, because...
Well, they've tried to bring those arguments up in federal court, but the federal courts will not even entertain those arguments for obvious reasons. If you were to rule it, you know, you could see the problem that would come. And, but there were some serious questions that happened back at the time in 1913 when that amendment was rammed through. It was the fastest ratified amendment in history, and there's some questions about it. It made for a great novel, and that's what I like. I like to find that thing from the past, something interesting, something fascinating that's real, and then weave a modern-day thriller around it, and that's sort of my thing.
Well, I think every April 15th, you should have a re-release of that book, and people will just, they'll buy it because they're going crazy with income tax, and I think just reminding them of that book, it will be terrific, because it is true that what you write there is factual. And, of course, you weave the mystery, you weave the story around it, and Cotton and, you know, and all the people get involved.
Yeah, I try to keep the books about 90% to reality. I keep them as close as I can. I have to trip it up because I'm writing a novel to entertain you, so that 10%. But then I have a writer's note in the back that's going to tell you where I trip that up so that there's no misunderstanding. And like you say, there's been 17 Cotton Malones, but those should not put the reader off. I do not write them where you have to read them in any particular order. You can skip around. You can pretty much read them however you want to, and you won't have trouble.
You skip around in history so beautifully.
Yes.
You go from one period to another. You're always coming out with some brilliant new idea based on a historical fact, and that's what makes it so wonderful. Your books are also so layered because of the fact that you have this backstory for Cotton. So for my listeners who don't know, just talk a little bit about Cotton, because I remember one of the books, which one is it? It's an earlier book, the one where about his father and the submarine.
Charlemagne.
I love that. I loved knowing this backstory. I thought it was so fascinating. So tell my listeners here about Cotton and your concept. Of course, he's so much based on you and your personality.
Yeah. Well, I created him in 2006 in the Templar Legacy, and when you create a new character, you want him to be kind of fresh. He's got to be fresh and a little bit different. So I made Cotton a retired Justice Department agent who lives in Copenhagen now, owns an old bookshop, and kind of gets himself into trouble by getting back into his old profession from time to time. And Cotton started with the Templar Legacy in 2006, and now he's here in the Last Kingdom 17 books later. And he's not a Daniel Craig kind of guy. He's not a James Bond shoot 'em up big physical guy. He's more like, I've always thought of him like a George Clooney kind of guy. He's like a guy next door, a guy that, you know, you would never think would be capable of these things, but he can rise to the occasion when he's called upon, and he can do extraordinary things when necessary. And he lives a quiet life now, but he gets drugged back in periodically and in these adventures, and he's caught on and done very well. I've been very surprised with it, and he gets to keep going on. Interesting thing, though, we have another character in the Cotton Malone series. His name is Luke Daniels. He's a younger character. Came in a few books ago. It's a younger version almost of Cotton, where he can make mistakes and mess up and screw up as he's learning what to do. He's going to get his own series starting June 27th. We're going to do three books with Cotton, with Luke Daniels. The first one is called The Ninth Man. It comes out June 27th, and it deals with something extraordinary from the Kennedy assassination, something I don't think many readers will know much about. I know I didn't when I discovered it. So that will be the first adventure, and then there'll be two more coming in the years ahead. And I'm writing those with the great thriller writer Grant Blackwood.
Ah, well, it's wonderful that Cotton has been mentoring him and bringing him along on the adventures, and of course in this one, in the new one. And I love that relationship. And of course, we have Cotton's wife, and tell us about her. And, you know, I have to say about him being an antiquarian and having a bookstore. Of course, that for me, that is like the perfect occupation. And I think it's so wonderful. You, of course, were a lawyer and a politician. It's hard to think of you as a politician for many years. But did you also dream about being an antiquarian bookstore owner?
Oh, I'd love to have owned a bookstore. It'd been a lot of fun. They unfortunately in today's world don't make a lot of money, and it's very difficult to have one nowadays. Those kinds of things are kind of gone. But Cotton has a rare bookstore. He deals in used books and rare books, so he's more of a collector's kind of guy, which would actually be kind of fascinating to do. So, and when I was creating him, I needed something different, something fresh, something that no one had done before, and that's why I came up with that idea of making him a bookseller. And we've used that, you know, several times over and over as part of the hooks of bringing in of how the stories start off and how the stories go. So it gives him a little freshness, a little bit different.
It gives him depth, and it's so much fun for me because I literally live in an antiquarian bookstore. I collect books. I have perhaps 500 books from the 1700s and 1800s. That's what I do, one of the things I do. At one point, I had 6,342 books.
Wow.
I've wheedled it down to 3,000. I live that life.
And you do
yeah,
that life.
But I'm not selling anything. I wouldn't sell anything. You become obsessed with them.
Yeah, that's Cotton's world. That's what he deals with. That's what he deals with every day, those rare books. And so one day I'm going to do a story that actually pivots around one of those books. I haven't really done that yet. All the stories really just involve him moving off the bookstore and going off and doing other things. But I want to do one that pivots right off an old book. So that may be something one day.
Oh, well, a book where somebody's written inside. I love when I find where some reader has written inside, and in fact I traced one reader to the family of a woman who bought a book back in 1870. She wrote lots of marginalia. I traced her family, so yeah, there's a lot there that Cotton can find.
There is. There definitely is.
One of the things I love about you, and of course your wife, that you have been very active in promoting writing and reading for veterans. And I think this is so important. Quite a few of my listeners are vets. Always tell them, you know, so many of them, particularly the ones suffering from PTSD, I tell them, write a book, not about your problems, but write any book. Write a children's book. Write a cookbook. Write just something that will take your mind off those things that are hurting you. And I know that you have visited on USO tours.
I did. I did a USO tour where we sent five writers over to Iraq. This is back when the war was going on. And we were the first group of writers ever sent into a war zone like that. And it was quite extraordinary. We got to meet with a lot of soldiers. And we found out reading is their number one recreational activity. And they have a lot of small libraries on all the bases, and we went around to five or six places in Kuwait and Iraq back then. And subsequently to that, they did it three or four more times, more writers, but we were the first experimental group to do it, and it was quite gratifying. I enjoyed it. It was a great honor.
Well, I know that they appreciate it, and it's something so important. I just want to get back to your wife for a minute. Now, your wife's name is Elizabeth, as a matter of fact, right?
That is correct.
But in the book, tell me about Cotton's wife.
Well, it's not really his wife yet.
Well, yeah, they're, I know.
Not wife yet, but close.
I think of her. He better not dump her.
Cassiopeia Vitt is his love interest, and they have a very close relationship. And that character is based a lot on Elizabeth. And you met her in the Templar Legacy, and then she's come along in the subsequent books. In the beginning, they didn't like each other very much, and now, of course, they're in love with each other. And they had a rocky relationship for a while, and I actually broke them up in one book. But I was going to keep them broke up and move on to something else, but Elizabeth said, no, that's not going to happen. So I brought them back together, and now they're kind of a team now. Mm-hmm. So their relationship has settled down, and they work together, and they've acknowledged their strengths and their weaknesses among themselves. And they're doing much better. And I've enjoyed now playing off each other. They've been together working as a solid team now for about three books. And in this book, she takes this book off. So she's not here, but she'll be back next year.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think of them as married.
Well, they do too. They think of themselves as married as well, but they're just both a little nervous about that. They don't want to go there. He didn't have a good experience the first time, and she's never been married before, so their relationship, I will probably keep it that way. Them getting married probably doesn't work per se. It works better the way it is now.
Well, it works very well, because it's a wonderful, wonderful relationship. Your books are wonderful. I'm so thrilled with the new one. As I said, particularly, I love them all, but really this one, because of the connection with Bavaria and my many trips to Bavaria over the years, and to Vienna, of course. And the only trip I still want to do in Europe, I lived in Europe for a long time. I traveled a lot. The only thing I never did was that Danube trip, and I want to take that the cruise on the Danube.
I've done that. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah. Oh, I know. And I just never had that time to do that, because of course I've been to Budapest for Sissy, to do the research. So I've done it on land, but I really want to go and do that. Well, it's so exciting to talk to you, and to really, your books are so relevant even today in so many ways. Just one book after another, there's always something in the books that open people's eyes, and I think people do follow along. Once they read your book, they do check the history, check the locations. Because you paint these wonderful pictures, you really take us to the locations, whether it's the Swiss Alps or now to Bavaria or all the other places. They're just so very, they're fine writing. And on top of it, I get to hear you talk, because I love your accent. I think the last time I talked to you, I think it was Kaiser's Web, and I was just thrilled. You just have that lovely drawl that is so nice.
That Georgia accent. That's where I was born and raised.
I know. Well, it's there, and it's lovely. I'm glad you kept it. Now, I'm in Clearwater, Florida, and you're on the other side, I think. If you ever get to the Clearwater area, you just have to tell me, and you can come in the studio. We'll spend an entire hour, because I would like you to give your brilliant advice to my listeners who are starting to write, because you are very succinct about it. You say, read and write.
Yep, that's right. You got to write these.
And you know what rejection is. You've been rejected. And so many times people will say to me, oh, well, he's famous. He's selling millions of books. He's never been rejected. And he doesn't know how hard it is. And I say, oh, yeah, I think he knows how hard it is.
I got that down. Yeah, we'll do that one day. I'll be glad to do it one day if I ever get down that way.
Okay, that would be wonderful. It would be a thrill. Again, everybody, you have to get this book. It is wonderful. It's relevant. It's important. And it's a fun read, and you will enjoy it. And again, Steve Barry, thank you for being on Joy on Paper today. The name of the book is The Last Kingdom. People can go to your website and find out more about you. These are standalone books. All of the books you can read in any order, and they're on different subjects, different cases in history, and they're brilliant.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you again so much for being on Joy on Paper. Bye bye.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye. Oh wow, what a guy. Oh. This is an amazing book. I love this book.